You're listening to the BibleChallenge.org Old Testament Studies. For more information, go to stpeterslakemary.org. Now here's the Reverend Charles Holt.
We're going to take a look at most of the book of 2 Samuel today. It is important to look at both 1 and 2 Samuel as a unified book. They really have always been read together as just one unified document. The section that we're going to look at is the reign of King David. Last week we looked at the transition between David and Saul, Saul's fall and David's rise. Where we start in chapter 2 is David's ascendancy to the throne of all of Israel eventually. He starts off just going to the throne of Judah, his own tribe. So let's first take a look at the structure of this section, and I put that on your handout. The main focus of 2 Samuel is almost entirely on the reign of King David. The first couple of chapters, David hears word of Saul's death and laments his death. That's in chapter 1. But the rest of the book is focused on David's kingship. The book follows basically a five-part structure. In chapters 2 through 4, we see David's rise to power over his tribe, Judah, which is the kingly tribe, as was prophesied in the book of Genesis. And then Israel, eventually all of Israel, comes under his rule. And we read how that happens. And then David has his downfall into personal sin. He's such a great warrior, and he's so brave and courageous, but he had his own faults and qualities that were both a blessing and a curse to him. And so we'll look at David's downfall into sin. And the consequences of that are in the next section, chapters 13 through 19. We see where David's house, his sons, actually bear even more fruit of his sin of lust and violence that was manifest. So like father, like sons. And then the last chapters of the book of 2 Samuel have to do with the entire nation of Israel being united under King David. One of the things that you can think about when you're thinking about an Old Testament book is, when was the book actually written? Because if you know generally when a book was written, it can speak to issues of that day using the stories of the earlier days. So one way to think about these biblical books is they were trying to make points to later generations of Israelites. Not just tell a history, but they were telling the history so that future generations would learn some things about themselves. And one of the things that happened in Israel's later history is that Judah and Israel actually became divided. And there was a civil war in Israel. And so I think that this book was written actually during that time of civil war and strife to really encourage the Israelites to, one, understand how they got there in the first place. The seeds of that civil war actually were in David's seed, in his wives' wombs. But that's where it started, that the seeds of that civil war. So I think the book was written to help Israel understand the sin that led to that civil war, but also to paint a picture of a united Israel. And these days of David and King Solomon were the glory days. With all the problems, they still were the days when Israel was united under one king. And so you get a bit of both. And I think in a lot of ways that is the point of 1 and 2 Samuel, to help lay that groundwork for those future generations of Israelites that would be hearing these stories and reading them. The beginning of this section begins with David taking over the throne of his own tribe. It ends with David ruling over a united kingdom of Israel as a priestly king and him purchasing the property, which will eventually be the Temple Mount. So let's first turn to David's rise to power in Judah. 12 tribes of Israel, Judah being the one that was the kingly tribe, and they had the southern section of Israel. that contained what would become the capital city of Jerusalem. So 2 Samuel begins with David's lament over learning of the deaths of Saul and Jonathan. But now the question becomes one of succession. Who's going to take Saul's place as the king? Will David rise to the throne? Or will one of Saul's heirs take the throne and establish his primacy? At first, the answer is both. David does take a throne, the throne of his tribe. But one of Saul's commanders, basically his right-hand man, Abner, establishes Saul's last remaining son as the heir to the throne of all Israel. And so while Judah went and followed David, the rest of Israel followed Abner and Saul. As the story progresses, that is going to be painted from the writer's perspective as a bad thing. You don't divide Israel. Again, remember, this is probably written to a divided kingdom, encouraging them that was not a good thing. So David is anointed king over Judah at Hebron. Now, Hebron was a significant city. This is where the patriarchs buried their wives and were buried. It was also the place where the spies, when they went into the land in Numbers 13, they went to Hebron, and they brought back fruit from Hebron, but they also brought back the bad report because the giants lived there, the Amalekites. So Hebron was also the place that when Caleb was 80 years old and he says, you know, I'm this old guy, but give me the hill country. It was Hebron that he went in and bested and beat the giants and won back Hebron. Hebron was a great place. It was a really choice piece of real estate. And so Hebron becomes the capital city of Judah. And this is the place where David is anointed as king and rules for 7.5 years from the city of Hebron. Abner, the commander of Saul's army, seeks to retain his power by establishing Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, to reign over Israel. So all the other tribes are going to be under Saul's son, Ish-bosheth. The result was a temporarily divided nation, Israel versus Judah. And the bad thing about that is it ends up with, in a sense, brothers spilling each other's blood. This is always the problem with civil war. I mean, think about the great civil war of the United States of America. It's brothers fighting against brothers. And family members are going to war against one another. And this is what happens. And it starts off with just a war of champions at the Pool of Gibeon. But it becomes a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. The downfall of the house of Saul comes through the arrogance of Abner. He really is the one who, in a sense, wanted to be king. He was using Ish-bosheth to be a puppet, basically. But Ish-bosheth was weak and not very effective. And so Abner was gaining more and more power and arrogance and strength. And he, as a symbol of his sort of status and I'm the man, he actually goes in and has relationships with some of Saul's widow/concubines. This, of course, creates a very disastrous thing for Ish-bosheth and Abner, and they divide. And we see the verse there on page 127. Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ish-bosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David." In other words, am I like a puppy to David? No. I've been loyal to you in Saul's house. You know, that's a dog's head is kind of a idiom that we're not familiar with, but that's basically what he's saying. Have I been, you know, I have a Labrador retriever, so I kind of understand this, but Labradors are so loyal to their masters. She was getting her hair cut yesterday, and I walked in while she was getting her hair cut, and I had to leave, and apparently Abby just really let the clippers know that, no, I don't need to be here, I need to be with him. Yes, yeah, they're just very loyal. And Abner is saying, I've been loyal to you. I haven't been a dog a puppy dog to David's house. I've been loyal to Saul's house. But because of Ishbosheth's criticism of Abner, he utters these words that actually become prophetic. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman? God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. So at that moment, Abner switches loyalties and he turns to establish the kingdom of David over all of Israel. Now, Abner would carry through with his promise. He'd go to David and he would go and speak to King David and offer himself to David's service. But David's right-hand guy, Joab, had a vendetta with Abner. One of Joab's sons was killed by Abner's men. So Joab settled this vendetta by taking Abner's life. And then you have King Ishbosheth, also murdered by his own captains. They think they're going to go and find David happy with their treachery. And instead, when they deliver Ishbosheth's head to King David, they find that David brings justice upon them. What would they expect? When David heard the news of Saul, and you remember the guy came about the death of Saul, and this Amalekite says, hey, you know, he was dying there. He asked me to run the sword through him and finish the job of his suicide that he started, and I did, and I killed him. And he thought, you know, I'm bringing you this good news. Saul's dead. David said, well, you just killed the Lord's anointed. You have to die. Well, the same thing happens now with these men. You just killed King Saul's son. Now you have to pay the price. And this is an interesting thing about King David. Always loyal to his predecessor. You know, he loved Saul. Saul chased after him and tried to kill him again and again and again. And yet he stayed faithful and loyal and respected Saul as the Lord's anointed. And he loved Saul's children. Loved Jonathan. Respected Jonathan. And really paid incredible tribute to his predecessor. And I think there's a huge lesson for leadership there and the issue of succession. You know, I have a predecessor, he's right up there, Father Barge. And, you know, it's important to honor the one that was before you and to make sure that you respect that person. That doesn't mean that they never did anything wrong. But David models here just a very interesting and I think a very important component to leadership and making sure that you honor what came before. I think one of the main reasons why this was important for David was because he had to win the hearts of these tribes and these people. And a lot of these people were very loyal to Saul. And they didn't quite understand why Saul's heirs didn't take the throne. And so he had to win hearts as much, not by power and the sword, but by winning hearts by being a gracious and a merciful guy and a loving person. And David, to his credit, really models mercy and kindness and grace to his predecessor and his predecessor's followers. So even the death of Abner, David lamented the death of Abner as one of the greats. He was not pleased that Joab had taken the law into his own hands and put him to death. I think one of the main principles that David had was Israel doesn't fight Israel. That's your family. And even if you have an enemy within your own house, you let God sort it out. They'll get theirs. But you don't go to war against your family. Now, to Philistines, he was ruthless. Right? Yes. I mean, if it was an enemy of Israel, he would have been ruthless. Wipe them all out. But to his own people, intensely loyal and very devoted. Even the ones among the people that were his enemies, He remained committed to them. David exercises justice on those who would kill the people from the house of Saul, but he also shows tremendous respect to Abner and Ish-bosheth and Saul's house. So what ends up happening when all of this comes to pass is that David then does win the hearts of the rest of the nation of Israel. And he is now set as king over both Judah and all of Israel. And we see that in chapter 5. And there's a place where the elders, the tribes of Israel, anoint David as king over all of Israel. And they recall the words that the Lord had spoken to David. You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel. And so David was set over all of Israel. Now in chapter 5, we find David having to deal with some unfinished business. There were really two things. One was unfinished business for his own tribe. When they had gone into the land of Canaan, and they were supposed to, under Joshua, completely and totally drive out the inhabitants of the land. Well, the tribe of Judah faltered with the Jebusites. They left them in charge of all cities, the city of Jerusalem. And so there are the Jebusites still holding the city of Jerusalem. The other piece of unfinished business was caused initially by the faltering conquests under Joshua and the judges, but it was made a lot worse under Saul with the Philistines. The Philistines were expansionary, and they had come in and taken large pieces of Israelite real estate. And so David, when he came over all of Israel and now has a united Israel, he is going to deal with these two pieces of unfinished business. The first is dealing with the Jebusites. And you read about that in chapter 5, in verse 6. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites. This is 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 6. And the inhabitants of the land who said to David, you will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off, thinking, David cannot come in here. Now, what did they done? They had put the unclean as their defense. And were trying to block David with blind and lame people, thinking, these people will ward him off. So David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. So he just went right through and took the city. And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. David built the city all around from Milo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. And a foreign Gentile king, the king of Tyre, which is located up on the Sea of Galilee, paid tribute to David and his greatness, I imagine, to build some good relationships with him, and sent his craftsmen and built David a cedar palace in the city of Jerusalem. And so David made Jerusalem his capital city for all of Israel. Used to be Hebron. He ruled in Hebron for 7.5 years and then reigned the rest of his reign in Jerusalem. So in chapter 6, we have the scene of the ark coming to Jerusalem. And at first, there's an episode. David wants to get the ark into the capital city so that the throne room of God is in the place where his throne room is. Remember, the ark is the footstool of the throne room of God. That's the best way to look at the ark. It's the footstool of the throne of God. And so David wants to bring those two throne rooms together. And so the ark is making its way by cart, and then one of David's men reaches out to steady the cart, and he touches the Ark of the Covenant and is killed, struck down by the Lord. You can't touch the Ark of the Covenant. You'll die. It's holy. God is holy. And David gets angry at God for doing this. What?
He was trying to keep it from falling.
I know. He thought he was doing a good thing. Yeah.
is that they've had oxen carrying the ark, and you're not supposed to do that.
Right, you had certain men that were supposed, there was a way to do it. So they weren't carrying it right. He's not supposed to touch. I mean, they were breaking God's commands. But here's the main point of that, and this is the lesson for David. You know, you start treating the ark and you start treating Yahweh as a little less reverent, and you start getting, you know, with the holy things, you get a little too comfortable and a little too easy with them. And God's going to wake you up and say, "Excuse me, I'm the Lord. And you need to pay attention to what you're doing and respect and revere. My name is holy." And so the death of Uzziah was a wake-up call for David to go, "Oh, I do need to be faithful and respectful of the ark." So, but David gets mad at the Lord, and he sends the ark to the home of a man named Obed-Edom. And Obed-Edom starts to get blessed, because the Ark of the Covenant's in his house. So for 3 months, Obed-Edom's like, abundance is coming to the house of Obed-Edom. And David gets wind of the blessings that have come on Obed-Edom's house, and he finally says, "No, bring the Ark back to Jerusalem." And so it's this incredible procession that happens as he's bringing the Ark of the Covenant into the house of, or into the gates of Jerusalem. Every six steps, he sacrifices an animal. Isn't that amazing? So they're just having dancing and celebrations, and it's happening very, very slowly as it makes its way properly into the city of Jerusalem. And David just gets caught up in the moment, and he rips off his clothes and starts dancing in front of the ark, and his wife, Michelle, is up in a window looking down on the whole thing, and she despises David in her heart. And after all of the celebrations are over, and this is in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 20, David returns to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David, and this is sarcasm here, okay? "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." You almost could hear this in the voice of the church lady, couldn't you? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, she's being very snide and sarcastic. And David says to Michal, "I wasn't doing it for anybody, view or sight, but for the Lord's. I don't care what you think about me or what you saw me doing. In fact, if that offended you, I'm going to do more things that are going to offend you. Because I'm going to, basically what David is saying is, I'm going to live for the Lord. And I'm not going to care what you think. I'm just going to live for the Lord." And so he says this to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. And I will celebrate before the Lord, and I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. This is all for the Lord."
Now, in defense of her, not...
Okay.
But she had been ripped from her home. I mean, when David came back and was reigning as king, I mean, she had been given as a wife to somebody else. So she had been taken without wanting to leave from her husband. And I mean, didn't it say that the husband came out weeping for his wife? And
right.
He was taken. So, you know, that kingly authority that just can rip a woman from her husband and take it into his concubine, where she's one of a plethora.
Sure. Michal was originally one who loved David and was David's wife.
Yeah.
And then you have just a web of sin with all of that, where you have Michal being after Saul gets angry at David, he takes her from David and gives her to this other man that you referenced. And then, yes, David gets her back and takes her out of that man's home.
Well, but it also shows conflict between Saul and David in the sense of she was Saul's
daughter, right? The other piece of unfinished business has to do with the battle over the Philistines. And David, of course, is given these incredible victories over the Philistines in chapter 5, 17 through 25. So when we get to chapter 7, David is purposing, now that the ark is in Jerusalem, David wants to build a temple. He wants to build a house for the footstool of God's throne. And so at first he says to the prophet Nathan, that's what I'm wanting to do. And Nathan says, well, if that's what the king wants to do, then, you know, go for it. But then Nathan, in a dream, gets a word from the Lord for David. And this becomes a very key passage in your Bibles. This should be starred. This is a very important passage. This is the establishment of the Davidic covenant. There are multiple covenants throughout the Bible. A covenant with Adam, with Noah, with Abraham, with Moses, with David, the new covenant. These different covenants are very, very important to know where those key verses are. This is the key verse for the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel chapter 7. David wants to build a house for the Lord, and the Lord says through the prophet, have I ever asked for a house? You know, I've been wandering through the wilderness, living in tents with all of you. When did I ever say, boy, I wish I had a house? You have the humor of the Lord here. And we get to this key passage in 2 Samuel verse 7, 11 through 16. I put it in your handout. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. So he says to David, David, you're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house. Remember what God said to Abraham? I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you a great nation. All the nations of the world will be blessed through you. This is the way Yahweh operates. You're not going to do for me. I'm going to do for you. And so this promise is that the Lord will build a house for David. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I'm going to raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now, in the short term, this would be fulfilled in the person of Solomon. Solomon, David's son to Bathsheba, would be the one to build the temple of the Lord. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It would be destroyed by the Babylonians and rebuilt, Herod the Great. But ultimately, the one who would be the heir that would establish his kingdom forever would be the person of Jesus, the Son of God. Notice what he says here. I'll establish his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. The Davidic covenant is the establishing of the Messiah as the Son of God. One of the things that a lot of people think when they hear Son of God, they think that's a divine title. It's a title of Jesus' divinity. It actually is a title of his human descendancy in fulfillment of the promise made to David. So when Jesus is called the Son of God, he's actually being called this king, this descendant of David. Actually, the Son of Man title is actually the one that has more of a divine connotation. Jesus' favorite way of referring to himself, we're going to get to that one in Daniel chapter 9. So let me press on, I'm sorry. So you'll notice here a couple of other things, that this will be an everlasting kingdom. That your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. David had, you know, obviously many heirs who were called the sons of God. Every time a new king was established in Israel, they would go through the liturgy in Psalm 2. I put verses 8 and 9 there from Psalm 2, where the king says, I will tell of the decree, the Lord Yahweh said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. The vision of the Davidic covenant was of not only an everlasting kingdom, but also one that was global in its scope. This is actually part of the reason why The nations of the world do not like Israel's claim, because Israel's claim is to be over all of the world. Of course, Jesus is the one who fulfills this completely. He will be the Son of God and the master temple builder. His body will be the new temple. 3 days I will destroy this temple, and he's pointing to the physical buildings, and I will raise up another, his body. Remember Jesus at his baptism, "This is my Son, whom I'm well pleased." So David, the promise of the Davidic covenant is fulfilled entirely in Jesus. When we get to chapters 10 through 12, David falls into sin. And this whole section is bookended by this war with the Ammonites. But this war is actually the occasion in which David reveals the character that is his downfall. And I've heard this before said of very passionate people, that passion is actually their greatest strength, but it's that passion is also their greatest weakness. And it's often those who are very charismatic leaders, and you see this happen where you have these amazing Christian leaders that are so passionate, and so often the thing that causes their downfall is their lust. We've seen that in our own area here recently. And it's in a lot of ways that kind of Davidic sin. It's a kingly sin that is loving and passionate and filled with the... But it's that sins of the love are actually some of the ones that can take us down. David lusted after the beautiful Bathsheba, but she was a wife of one of his loyal soldiers, Uriah the Hittite. And so David impregnates her, and he tries to cover up his sin by asking Uriah to come home and encouraging Uriah to go be with his wife. And Uriah is a man of honor, and he sleeps outside the door of David's palace and says to David, "The ark of and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat, to drink, to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." I mean, he's such a man of integrity and honor, and that is so contrasting David's sin here and his dishonor with what he's done. And to make matters worse, because of Uriah's honor and David's dishonor, he makes his sin double by sending Uriah out to the front lines, pulling and asking his commanders to pull back and let Uriah be shot and killed. And indeed, this is what happens. David, in this one little section here, displeased the Lord is one thing, 11 verse 27, but he had committed adultery, murder, and lost the respect of his commanders all in one fell swoop. Amazing what lust will do. It's a very powerful thing that can take great men down. How do you confront a king? Well, Nathan does a great job of using a story, a parable, to shame him, and tells a story about a rich man who takes advantage of a little poor man with his little lamb, and the rich man, instead of using one of his own lambs, takes the poor man's lamb and uses that to entertain his guests. And David said, "Who's the man that did this? How dare somebody treat somebody so poorly?" And Nathan points the finger and goes, "You the man. You're the one that did this." And David repents, but he also has to deal with the consequences of his sin. And so just moving forward a little bit quicker, what you find in chapters 13 through 19 is David's wives, and this was again part of his problem. He liked women. Lust was a problem for David. But all of those wives created a lot of half-brothers and half-sisters. And full brothers have and full sisters have much more loyalty to one another than half-brothers and half-sisters. And so one of the half-brother-sister pairs was Absalom and Tamar, and one of their half-brothers raped Tamar. And his lust then turns to hate as he absolutely hates his sister. Absalom then is Tamar's brother, goes to war and sees that his sister is vindicated, Amnon's death. And Absalom flees out of fear of his father's judgment, but ultimately works his way back into the presence of David over a course of years. David kisses his son, but Absalom harbors enmity towards his father and steals his father's kingdom from him. This section describes David fleeing from his son, and eventually Absalom gets hung up in an oak tree as a donkey is his mule is going to battle against David's men, Joab and David's soldiers, and Absalom is caught hanging in an oak tree. When it's reported to Joab, Joab goes and kills him with his spear. When this all gets reported back to David, again we see the weakness of David, and that he laments the death of his son, and chides Joab for doing this. And Joab confronts him back to his face and says, "We have been loyal to you as your mighty men. We have fought with you against Saul and all your enemies for all these years. And you love your rebellious kin more than you love us, your commanders, your warriors." And so he says, "You get out there and act like a king." And David goes and stands and sits out in front of his people in a kingly spot. And in a sense, the kingdom is preserved. But you see, the weaknesses of David have caused tremendous amount of problems that will bear much fruit even beyond this story as we get into 1 and 2 Kings, which we will come next. The way that the book of 2 Samuel ends, though, is with David's last words and David purchasing the temple of the Lord. But I'll leave you to just meditate on the last words where David says that it's by the Spirit of the Lord that kings rule justly over men with the fear of God. Worthless men don't follow the Lord, but feel the experiences or the consequences of their sin. David is one who fears the Lord. The worthless men, plenty of examples of those as well.
Thanks for listening. For more information, check out stpeterslakemary.org.